Welcome to the Wealth Setting Podcast. I'm your host, John Pugliano. I'm the founder and money manager at InvestableWealth.com. Today is September 23rd, 2014. This is episode 28. We're here to talk about all things related to your personal finances and helping you build wealth. Money may not buy you happiness, but it can buy you freedom. If you're new to the podcast, and many of you are, please go back and listen to the first 10 episodes. That's where I lay out my philosophy on building wealth and lay out the 10 wealth-building principles. Now, in this episode, we're going to answer some listener questions, but I'm also going to spend a lot of time on a market review. The market has been very volatile over the last 3 weeks, and particularly very treacherous over the last 3 days. So I do want to spend some time explaining that to you and giving you my opinion of what's going on. Before we get started, I do want to welcome all the new listeners. I can tell from the statistics that there are many, many of you that are coming in new each day, downloading these episodes. Just in the last week or so, we seem to have gotten a significant amount of people that are using Android devices. Now, when it comes to podcasting, I'm mostly familiar with Apple and the iTunes Store, and that's mostly where my emphasis has been. So for those of you that are using Android devices, I hope you're being served properly. I don't know if you're using an Android and still going in through the iTunes Store, or if you're using Stitcher or some other device. Frankly, I'd be interested in hearing from you. I'd be interested to know how you found out about the show and what app or what method you're using to listen to it. Now, I went out to Stitcher, and we are currently listed there, but I didn't see any ratings or reviews or anything that would direct people to us. So again, that's why I'm not sure how all you Android users may be finding us. Now, we have done fairly well in the iTunes Store ratings. Again, I want to thank all of you that made an effort to go out and rate and review the show. We have close to 20 reviews out there now, and I know those of you that did had to make a special effort to do it. And whether you wrote just one line or some of you wrote some substantial information, I really, really appreciate that. That helps me build a community. And the more feedback I get and the more listeners I get communicating with me, hopefully the better I can make the show for all of you. I know your efforts are also helping other people decide whether or not they want to listen to the episode. Everybody's time is very valuable, so people do go in there because I know I do it myself. I read the description of the podcast, and then I look and see what people are saying about it. And you guys are saying great things about the Wealth Setting Podcast, so I really appreciate it. In fact, one of the common themes that run through a lot of statements, one is the fact that many of you find the 10 wealth building principles very useful. And I'm glad. I spent a lot of years thinking about those and developing them. And I do too. I think they're useful. That's why I put them out there, and I put them out there for free. I'd like as many people to know about them and to practice them and to integrate them into their life as possible. So I'm glad they're getting good reception. The other current theme that runs through a lot of the reviews is that this is kind of a no-frills, no-fluff, no-BS podcast. And I like that as well. Maybe they'll put that in my tombstone. John Pugliano, no-fluff. Well, I'm going to do the best that I can to keep it that way. No BS, just good solid information. Everything I tell you is based on my life experiences. I have nearly 30 years as an individual investor. I'm a late-blooming entrepreneur, so I feel that I can talk to you not only about the investment industry, which I'm part of, but also about starting a small business and how a lifestyle business can make a huge difference in your life. So again, welcome to all the new listeners. Reach out to me. Contact me through the website, wealthsetting.com. Let me know how you're listening to the show, how you found out about it, and of course, any questions or comments would be appreciated. So let's start off this episode by doing a market review. It's not only been a rough couple of days, but a rough couple of weeks. The market has been extremely volatile. Now, the comments I'm going to make today also parallel a blog article that I put on my website a few days ago. This is my firm's website, which is investablewealth.com. If you look under the observation and commentary tab on that website, you'll find all my posts, and the most recent one is the one I'm talking about. It was entitled, Market Volatility While the U.S. Dollar Rises. And again, now this post is a few days old, so the market has been even more volatile since I wrote that. So when I refer to volatility, I mean that each day the market has not only had a wide and varied performance, but it's also varied drastically week to week. Over the past 2 or 3 weeks, the major indexes like the NASDAQ and the S&P 500, they hit record highs, and then they abruptly dropped and fell. In the case of the NASDAQ falling over 2%, and the S&P 500 over 1.5%. Now, while a couple percent isn't a drastic number in terms of some of the Black Tuesday events we've seen before where the market has dropped 20 or 25% in a day, right? I'm not saying it's that volatile, but I want to point out, because the market has performed so well in the last 2.5 or 3 years, many investors are convinced that volatility has gone away, that the market's going to keep going up. They don't realize how easy it is to lose 2 or 3%, and the market is easily dropping at that rate over a day or two. For example, today, all three major indexes, the NASDAQ, the Dow Jones Industrial, the S&P 500, they were all down about 0.5%. Yesterday, the NASDAQ was down over 1%. The day before that, it was down nearly just about 0.5% that day as well. So in the last three trading sessions, it wiped out all the gains that were made in the previous three. And then prior to that, in two trading sessions, the NASDAQ had wiped out nearly 3 weeks of gains in just 2 days. That's what I talk about when I say a volatile market. In previous episodes, we talked about this as well. I talked about going to websites like investors.com, where you can see a chart that'll give you a graphic representation of what the stock is doing every day over a 6 month or so period. They use a form of candlesticks, which is really just a bar graph. They're in red for the down days and blue for the up days. If you go there today and you look at a chart of one of the major indexes, you'll see how long those individual bar charts are for each individual day. That represents that during the day, the stock traded for a long extreme. It may have been up or down as much as 1 or 2% in that day alone. That's volatility. If you go back 4 or 5 weeks, you'll see where the indexes were trading much tighter. That's important for you to recognize. You'll also notice that when the market closes, that closing price tends to be in the lower half or maybe even the lower 25% of the day's trading range. Again, that's an indication that people may be coming in during the day and buying on the dips and raising the price, but by the end of the day, and as the phrase does say, it says at the end of the day, well, at the end of the day, people are selling and the price is dropping. That's not a good sign. You also see that that closing price, particularly in the NASDAQ, is getting very close to the 50-day moving average. That's a sign that we've talked about as being thin ice. Oftentimes, a stock or an index will hit the 50-day moving average and then bounce off of it. That's a good entry point. That's a good time to get in. When it breaks through and falls below that 50-day, that's a real concern. Now, while I'm thinking about it, before I continue with the market review, a couple things I want to mention. One, again, investors.com, that's Investors Business Daily's website. I'm a big proponent of that newspaper. I don't work for them, don't get any kickbacks, anything like that. I subscribe to them. As a money manager, I rely on their information and their articles to help keep myself informed. Well, I wanted to mention that for the next week or so, they're offering free access to the premium features on their website. So from September 22nd to October 5th, if you go to the website and sign up, I believe all they ask you for is your email address. They'll give you access to not only their newspaper, but all their premium services, such as the charting services and articles and news services. So definitely something, you know, if you're interested in learning more about investing, this is free. This was something that would cost you, depending upon what you used of it, you know, several hundred, $200-$300 a month. Go give it a free try. The other thing I wanted to mention, and this is in regards to the 50-day moving average. There have been several articles in the past few days about the Russell 2000. Now, the Russell 2000, that's the index fund for small capitalized companies. So that's the smallest 2,000 companies. Traditionally, that's where the growth comes from. That's where the most risk and the most potential growth would be. The Russell 2000 has been performing pretty poorly all year long. But just in the past day or so, the 50-day moving average for the Russell 2000 crossed below the 200-day moving average. That's commonly called a death cross. And again, I bring this up because there's been a lot of articles about it, a lot of projections of gloom and doom. And as I always stress in these podcasts, you want to be careful where you get your news sources from. Most things are only hype. They're just there so the media provider can sell advertising or so someone can hawk a book to you or whatever. But you have to glean truth in where you can find it. So when they talk about the 50-day moving average, when it breaks down below the 200-day moving average, when they talk about that being a death cross, it is called that for a reason. Historically, it has been an indicator, an early warning indicator, that there could be trouble ahead of a correction in the marketplace, or worse yet, of even a bear market. Now again, put the hype aside. Every time the 50-day moving average does that death cross and crosses a 200-day moving average, that does not guarantee a bear market. It doesn't even necessarily guarantee a correction. Statistically, I haven't done the studies. I don't know how many times it does or doesn't indicate that a bear market's coming, but what I do know is that it's not good news. Now again, oftentimes if that happens to a stock or an index, it can bounce off that 200-day moving average and start moving up, so it could signal that you're at a market bottom. You have to look at all things that are currently going on. You just can't look at this one indicator. And again, this is what I want you to remember with all things. People are constantly asking me, John, how long does this last? Or what kind of return should I expect to get? Or what kind of economic indicator can I use? And there are no cut and dry answers. It's not that easy. If it was that easy, everyone would be wealthy. And you can look around and see that many people aren't. So it's not that easy. It's not an exact science. No one has an algorithm. No one has a crystal ball. So take a lot of these things with a grain of salt, but do be conscious that the Russell 2000 has done the death cross, and again, that's where the 50-day moving average has crossed below and broken below the 200-day moving average. And just as a little bit of a review, the 50-day moving average gives us an indication of how the stock has performed over the last 2.5 months. And since earnings are announced every 3 months, that 50-day moving average generally correlates with either what's been announced for earnings or what's anticipated to be announced for earnings. So when the average price over this most recent earnings period drops below the 200-day moving average, which is your average price for the year, it gives you an indication that investors are either not happy with current earnings or they're worried about future earnings. And the final price of any stock ultimately always comes down to earnings. It's either based on current earnings or it's based on earnings expectations. People don't buy a stock just to buy it. They buy it for value. If they don't think they're going to get a return, they'll sell the stock. If more people sell than buy, the price will go down. So that's why that death cross should concern you. And again, it should concern you because it's happening with small cap stocks. These are normally the growth engine for the economy. This is normally where you see the first signs of improvement happening. The Russell 2000 generally acts as a leading indicator. If people are running away from the small cap stocks, then maybe soon they'll be cutting out of the large cap stocks as well. And that gets back to the article that I wrote on investablewealth.com. I talked about how the markets are not only volatile, how they've been hitting highs and then precipitously dropping another 2% or so, and doing this 2 or 3 times over as many weeks. But I also mentioned in that article how although these large cap stocks are doing very well, now these are the dividend paying stocks, many of these smaller stocks, the ones in the Russell 2000 that I just mentioned, they've had a very tough year. In fact, I believe more than half of them are off about 20% from their highs. Now a bear market, by definition, is a 20% drop from a high. So you can say about 50% of the small cap stocks are currently in a bear market. Now you wouldn't know that from reading the headlines, because all the media seems to be focusing on is how the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500 keep hitting record highs. You have to remember, these indexes, they're geared to market capitalization. So the bigger the stocks are, the more they're weighted in the index. So a large stock like Google or Apple, if they do well, that could raise the index. While at the same time, if 1,000 other stocks are doing poorly, it may not affect the index because these large, these very big stocks are overshadowing the poor performance of the small stocks. So again, don't just look at numbers at face value. Dig down into the details. Now what further concerns me about these large cap stocks making all-time highs, it isn't that they're being offered at bargain prices. These things are getting very pricey. They're either fully priced or, in my opinion, overvalued. Now, as always, in this podcast and future podcasts and past podcasts, I'm not giving you financial advice. I'm just giving you some of my opinions, and I'm trying to give you the education so you can think through and learn these things for yourself. So don't consider this information as something you should go out and trade in. Just consider it as informational, and only my opinion. So again, in my opinion, I'm concerned about these large cap stocks because I do think they're pretty pricey. And I say that based on their valuations. That's their price to earnings ratio. Now the price to earnings ratio, it's a number. It's a ratio, as the name implies. And like any other number, in and of itself, it doesn't mean anything. You have to take it in context and you have to compare it to other things in the economy and other situations. But when I look at these large cap stocks, for example, the ones that are trading on the Dow Jones Industrial Average, about 30% of the Dow stocks are trading over 20 times earnings. That means they have a price per earnings ratio of more than 20. So to break that down for you, what that means, what that valuation means is that's if you took the earnings, if they were earning $1 per share, then the share price, since it's 20 times earnings, the share price would be $20 a share. So for example, if Apple is trading at $100, then it would be earning $10 a share. 10 times 10 would be 100, and so the sale price, the price it would cost you to buy the stock, would be $100. Now, Apple is actually trading for a pretty reasonable valuation. It's only trading for, I think, 14 or 15 times earnings. So not too far off that 10 times earnings that I mentioned in our example. But over 30% of these stocks on the Dow, now these are big stodgy stocks. These are big blue chip stocks that aren't known for their growth. They're not necessarily known for having extremely high earnings potential. Now, they do pay dividends, and they're very stable. But paying 20 times their earnings, in many cases, I think might be asking a lot. It might be overvalued. And again, I'm just saying it might. You need to study it and determine this for yourself. But think about it. When you talk about that valuation, a price per earnings ratio of 20, that's 20 times earnings, what you're really saying is that you're willing to buy that stock for what it'll take to earn over the next 20 years. Now, because the time value of money and all, that's not exactly true. But for our purposes, just think of it in those terms. And to relate that to a small business, Imagine that you were going to go out and you were going to buy something in your community. A small business that you were going to, that was already up and running, the entrepreneur was either just selling out or they wanted to retire, and you wanted to buy into that business. Would you pay them a premium of 20 times earnings? So for example, if that business was generating $100,000, would you pay $2 million for that business? No way. Never. In fact, a small business in your community, I would say you're probably not going to pay anything more than maybe 3 times earnings. Depends on where you live and what kind of business it is, obviously, and what the growth rate is. And really, that's what it all comes down to, is growth rate, and I'll get to that in a minute. But just imagine that you're looking in Craigslist or some kind of business listings where you see that small business owners have their business up for sale. Take a look at the earnings, not the sales, not the top line revenue, but the actual earnings, the earnings that that company is making. And incidentally, that's why if you're a small business owner, it's very important that you have good books, that you can prove what your earnings are, because when it comes time to sell it, people are going to buy it based on those earnings. But in any case, you're going to find that most of these small businesses are only going to sell at a value for about 3 times. So on a business that was generating $100,000 profit, it would probably be reasonable for you to pay $300,000 for it. So that would mean that you'd have a payback of 3 years or less, because you're also probably thinking that you can improve that business. You can run it better than the owner did. You think there's more value there than the owner does, obviously, or you wouldn't be buying it. So it probably has what you think is an improving marketplace, or you think that your abilities and skills can make it grow faster. So in 3 years or less, you're going to get your money back. And then every year after that, it's just gravy, right? You're now making $120,000, $130,000, $200,000 a year, when all you had to lay out for the business was $300,000. So that's the valuation. In that case, you'd be paying 3 times earnings, a price per earnings ratio of 3. Now, you hear me talking about these blue chip stocks, and I'm telling you it's a 20-time evaluation. That's a big difference. Why would you pay so much more to own a stock as opposed to some real tangible business that you can own in your community? Well, it really all comes down to probably liquidity and transparency. Let me try and sum it up this way. When you're buying a local business, although it's in your community and you may know that the business owner is an honest and ethical person and you may know the local economic and business conditions of your area, you're still taking a risk. It's a small business. A lot of things can happen with a small business. And in many cases, you're going to be responsible for not only owning that business, but you're going to be running it, right? You're going to be managing. Any business that requires your time to run is going to take away from the value of that business. It's going to take away from the valuation. Because even if you're not paying yourself a salary, even if you're just living off the dividends off of it or off the earnings of it, you're still putting forth your time and effort to manage it. So if you buy a small local business for 3 times earnings, it probably isn't an absentee ownership. If it were, you'd be paying more than that 3 times that I talked about. Maybe you'd be paying 5 or 6. But if you're there and you're actively managing it, again, you're probably going to only be paying 3 or less. Now compare that to buying Apple stock. And let's just say Apple stock is at a 15 times earnings. If you buy Apple stock, you're not going to spend any of your time and effort managing that company. They're not going to be calling you up asking you for your advice. You're not going to have to be filling in for employees that don't show up when they're sick or during holidays. You're not going to have to worry about funding it or making payroll, right? You just simply own the stock. That's not true if you own a small business. The transparency of it, too, is the point I'm trying to make. You don't know how much time and effort you're going to have to put into running that business until you actually buy it. When you buy Apple stock, you know you're not putting any time and effort into running the business. As far as transparency goes, when you're buying a local business, too, again, you don't know the true status of those books. You don't know if the owner was really defrauding you. You don't know what the market conditions are going to be next year. With Apple stock, you can have a reasonable expectation of how many iPhones they'll sell or how many iPads or whatever, because they've been in business for so long. They have a record. You can rely on the data and the numbers coming out of Apple stock, or at least you feel you can. Certainly you feel that those are more reliable and more transparent than anything you're going to see from a local business. So that's a transparency part, and it's also the effort that's required by the owner. The other side of it is liquidity. Now, if you buy that local business and you want to sell it, chances are you're probably not going to be able to sell it on your own. You're probably going to have to go through a business broker. Yeah, you might be able to put an advertisement on Craigslist or something on your own, try and sell it by owner, but that might be difficult. And even if you're successful at it, it's going to take time. You're going to have to evaluate owners, make sure they have the finances. If you do go through a business broker, you're probably going to pay maybe like a 10% commission. And again, it's going to take time and effort. You're going to have to advertise it. You're going to have to try and find an owner that has the money to be able to purchase it, or you're going to have to finance the purchase yourself, which again is taking on additional risk. So that business, although maybe you can sell it, it's not very liquid. Now again, contrast that with a stock. Contrast that with Apple stock. If you buy Apple stock and 2 seconds later you decide you don't want it, you can easily, with a click of a mouse, sell that stock at a discount broker, you can do it almost within an instant, and it's only going to cost you, maybe a $10 commission. That's highly liquid, and you pay a premium for that. But when we look at these blue chip stocks, these are these big, stodgy, dividend-paying stocks, we realize we're going to pay a premium. We're going to pay a premium because they have good books. There's great transparency. They trade tens of millions of shares a day, so you're not going to find better liquidity. They're name brands. So maybe like Apple, they are worth 15 times earnings. Historically, you can argue maybe they're even worth something as high as 16 times earnings. But I'm pointing out to you that many of these stocks, many of these big old stodgy blue chips, are trading at over 20 times earnings. Over 20 years of earnings would have to accumulate just to get your money back. Now again, you can't take that price per earnings ratio and just look at it in terms of a number. You have to put that in context. You have to say, well, how fast is that company growing? Because obviously, if they're growing their earnings and their sales at 300% a year, then you would absolutely want to pay 20 times earnings for it, because it's not going to take you 20 years to get your money back, because they're tripling or quadrupling every year. So you get your money back in a few weeks or months. But again, I don't think that's the case with these big, stodgy, blue chip stocks that I'm talking about. Companies like Johnson & Johnson, Coca-Cola, Procter & Gamble, I mean, these guys are barely growing at all if they are growing. Their top line sales, their top line revenue, it's not that impressive. Again, in many cases, it's flat or declining. Much of their earnings, even though they may be reporting 6, 7, maybe 10% earnings growth, you have to dig down and see how much of that is because of stock buybacks. These high valuations on these mediocre stocks are just very concerning to me. I think one of the reasons we're seeing such high valuations is because people are chasing interest rates. The Federal Reserve has held down interest rates so low that it's hurt savers. It's hurt not only individual savers, but institutions, people like insurance companies, pension funds. They can't get any return on their money if they put it in traditionally safe vehicles like 10-year treasuries. They're only paying about 2.58%. So these investors, small investors as well as large investors, they've gone into the stock market. They've gone into these blue chip stocks that maybe are paying 2 or 3%. They're capturing that dividend, and they're also receiving appreciation as the stocks have risen over the last, say, 18 months to 3 years. So that's good, but it's only good while it lasts. It was very good a couple years ago if you could get into these stocks when they were trading for 10, 11, 12 times earnings. Again, I keep referring to Apple. Apple's around 14 or 15 times earnings. I think my money's safer at Apple than it is at someplace like Home Depot. Again, I'm not recommending Apple over Home Depot. I'm just pointing that out as a thought experiment. Think about it. Where do you think your money's safer? I think I'd rather buy Apple at 15 times earnings than buy Home Depot at, say, 20, 22 times earnings. It's something you have to think about and work out on your own. But you should be aware of it. You should be aware that people are chasing these dividends. You should also be conscious of what I talked about when I mentioned liquidity. Liquidity means you can sell and move out of that stock at lightning speed. So when the economy hits a bump in the road, or when investors are concerned that their stocks are going to go down, they're going to punch out of these stocks. They're going to forget about that 2% dividend. They're going to be saying, why should I risk 20 times earnings just to get a 2% dividend? And again, remember I'm telling you that the stock market just in the past few days has fluctuated easily over 2%. So why put your money at risk for 12 full months just to get a 2% dividend when that dividend can easily be wiped out in one afternoon of trading? If there's a bump in the road in the economy, these investors and these traders will be heading for the exit, and these high-flying stocks that are now trading at 20 or more times earnings could easily drop precipitously. You have to be conscious of that. You have to be aware of it. Now, do I know this is going to happen? Am I predicting this or forecasting it? No, I have no way of knowing, but neither does anybody else. I do know some facts, though. The Federal Reserve is telling us that they're bringing QE3 to an end next month. Now, they've been whittling down the $85 billion a month for almost a year now. That'll go away completely after next month. So the Federal Reserve is tightening up a little bit on our monetary supply. And at the same time they're doing this, at the same time the American economy is showing some decent improvement, overseas and foreign markets are not. China is slowing down. Europe is slowing down. They're worried about deflation there. Japan has been fighting a deflationary, shrinking economy for the last 25 years, and they're continuing to do that. So what we're seeing is, while the Federal Reserve is talking about tightening up our monetary supply because things are weak overseas, the Asian and the European central banks, they're talking about either re-stimulating or continuing their stimulation programs. They're talking about further easing the money supply. That's why interest rates in countries like Germany and France are below 1%. Here in the United States, we're at like almost 2.6. Why would you put your money in a French bond that's paying less than 1% when you can buy an American Treasury bond for 2.6%? Well, the answer is you wouldn't. And that's why a lot of that money is coming into America. It's coming into the United States. That's why we're seeing our stocks appreciate. That's why we're seeing, even over the last 6 weeks, the U.S. dollar rising. And that's a final point I want to make in terms of the market analysis. And this goes back to what worries me, not only about the small cap markets, but also about the big blue chip stocks. As the American dollar rises, it could put pressure, it could put downward pressure on stocks. Now don't get me wrong, I'm a fan of a strong dollar. Our dollar has lost way too much value over the last 50 years. I want a strong U.S. dollar. But at the same time, you remember this house of cards? It's been built on a weak dollar, particularly since 2000. I don't have the statistics in front of me, but I think the value of the U.S. dollar has lost 35% in the last 14 years. Now, for the last year in particular, the dollar's been low. And just in the last 6 weeks or so, it's risen about 4 to 5%. And it's risen as we've seen these overseas economies cool down, as we've seen the interest rates in Europe drop, and as we hear Japan and China and even the European Central Bank now talking about easing and more stimulus. That's made the U.S. dollar appreciate and rise. And when the dollar increases, it can be a headwind or it can put a burden on U.S. companies that export. Our exports become more expensive. So that could be a problem, again, to the small cap companies as well as to the large capitalization companies. The other reason that could be a problem, and this is particularly true of the big blue chip companies, you've heard me say that if you only had one index to invest in, you should invest in the S&P 500, because you not only get the 500 biggest and best American companies, but over half of their profits come from overseas. So you get a lot of diversification that way. Well, that also works against you. Now, the fact that these big blue chip companies derive so much of their income from overseas markets, now that can act as a double-edged sword to you, right? It can cut both ways. It works great for diversification when overseas markets are going up, but what about now? What about when they're soft? What if things are really slowing down in China? What if Europe is going into recession? Well, these big companies, they're not going to be deriving all their earnings from overseas, are they? Not if the markets are soft. That's going to hurt their bottom line. The other thing to consider, as we mentioned, is as our U.S. dollar rises, our exports become more expensive. So they're not only selling into a softer market, but they're selling into a softer market with higher prices than what the locals can deliver at. So they're going to get cut that way. And then the third thing that worries me about the rising dollar is that all these companies that operate overseas, and maybe they're just operating with services, not necessarily selling products, so they're not exporting from the U.S., but they have operations overseas. Well, normally when they make that money overseas and then they bring it back to the U.S. or they report it as U.S. earnings, if the U.S. dollar's been declining like it has been, then they get a currency exchange appreciation. They're converting like a higher dollar euro into a lower dollar U.S., and it translates into higher profits. Well, that cuts against them if the dollar's rising. Their profits overseas are going to be worth less when they convert them back over into U.S. dollars. So I see this rising dollar as potentially being a headwind, potentially being detrimental, particularly to the large cap stocks. That concerns me. Now again, that's only my opinion. I'm not predicting a downtrend. I'm not telling you to go out and sell all your stocks. That's not what this podcast is about. As an investment advisor, I can't even legally do that. I'm not offering advice. I'm just teaching you to think. And these are things that you should be thinking about and considering. These are the things that I think about. So take this information in the spirit it's given, think through it, and see how you can apply it in your own life. Now, I've taken a lot of time with the market review, but since the markets have been so volatile, since they've gone up and down so much in just the past few weeks, and particularly since the last few days have been so brutal, I thought it was important that we spend a lot of time on it. So I hope you found that useful. Now, let me just take the remaining time to answer a few listener questions. Now, last Friday was what was called Quadruple Witching Day. And I've gotten several questions about what that means or what that is. Whenever they talk about witching, and sometimes they call it quadruple witching or triple witching, it refers to the expirations of things like option contracts. Now, things like futures and options, they all have expiration dates. They're not like stocks. You can buy a stock and you can own it forever. You can pass it on to your descendants. But futures contracts and options, they all have expiration dates. And that means that their life comes to an end. They have to be converted in some form to money. They have to either be exercised or traded. They have to be closed out. And historically, that happens on the third Friday of the month. Actually, it's the third Saturday of the month, but since the market is closed on Saturdays, they all expire, close a business on the third Friday of the month. Now, I say historically because that's the way historically was. There are now options contracts that they may expire every Friday, but still the vast majority of them, the bulk of options, the bulk of these futures contracts, they will expire on the third Friday. And when we talk about things like double or triple or quadruple witching, that's when multiple things happen on that third Friday. So instead of just being the normal monthly third Friday where something's closing out, maybe it's also the end of the quarter. Now, in terms of the witching, they refer to it as witching because, you know, this is an old-fashioned term. And because these expirations cause so many shares to be traded, you know, so much volume to be happening, there's a lot of, you know, bewitching things that can happen. There's a lot of magical or unexpected things that can happen on that day. So that's why they're called witching. It's something that you should be cautious of, sort of like a superstitious Friday. Now, the reason I bring this up is because last Friday was one of these witching days, and several people had asked about it. Always be conscious that if you are entering into some kind of a contract or some kind of an option, if you're buying a put or a call, it's going to have an expiration date, and most likely it's going to expire on the third Friday of the month. If you're not trading options or something, it really doesn't affect you, other than the fact that that witching element is out there. It may make that particular Friday more volatile. It will certainly make that Friday have more shares trading hands. And again, that can affect the price. I'm always stressing to you not only to look at the price of a stock, but to also look at the number of shares it traded hands that particular day. If you want to see what a quadruple witching day looks like, go over to investors.com, bring up one of the charts on the index, the S&P 500, or the NASDAQ. Look at last Friday. That would have been Friday, September 19th. Look at that on a chart that shows volume, and you'll see just the astronomical amount of shares that were traded that day. Now, the final listener question and what I want to wrap up this episode on is on Alibaba stock. I didn't talk about it before the IPO was released because, again, it was really all hype. It didn't relate to us. And when I say it didn't relate to us, what I mean is those initial public offerings, they're not offered to common investors like us. They're not offered to retail traders like us. Sure, we can go out and buy Alibaba, but we have to wait until the day that it becomes public. And in this case, this would have been last Friday. All the news leading up to that, all the dog and pony show and all the hype, that was in reference to Alibaba going out on a roadshow and them trying to get investment firms, pension funds, hedge funds, people like that, to pre-buy this stock. We weren't going to get a shot at it. These stocks can make you a lot of money. They can make you a lot of money fast. But common everyday people like us aren't going to get an opportunity to buy into them. If it's being offered to me or you, it's flawed. That's just the way it is. What did George Carlin used to say about a big club and you ain't in it? Now, as far as Alibaba, it was a legit offering, and that's in fact why it wasn't offered to you until after it became available to the public. The people that got in early, they got in at something like $68 a share. It opened on Friday morning at $92 a share. So do the math on that. They bought it at $68, and they could have immediately sold it at $92. That's why you didn't get offered to buy it. There were way too many people standing in line for it. In fact, and again, this is only my opinion, but I feel that a lot of those IPOs are really crooked deals in the way that who they're offered to. And for example, the reason I say this, and I can't think of a specific example today, but I remember this has happened over the last 20 or 30 years as I've been following these things. The next time a politician releases their tax records, and you can see where their income has been generated, and though supposedly they have these blind trusts where they don't see what happens within them, they don't see what stocks are being traded for them because, you know, some money manager is doing it for them. I recall several politicians, and this is both sides of the aisle, both Democrats and Republicans, I remember them having an inordinate amount of access to IPOs. So my suspicious, cynical mind asked myself, well, now why do all these politicians get in on these sweet and early deals that aren't available to the general public, but somehow they get offered to them? Is it a payoff? Is it crony capitalism? Well, I don't know. I'll let you draw your own conclusions. But check it out. Okay, so I digress. But that's why I didn't bring up Alibaba. Guys like you and I weren't going to get into it. But now that it is made public, I will comment. As to Alibaba itself, I've been familiar with them for a number of years, probably going back to when they originated. I was traveling to China quite a bit at that time. So I'm familiar with their origin. I've seen them progress over the years. They do seem to be making money. In many cases, they may have been the only source of growth that you've seen at Yahoo over the years because Yahoo has owned a substantial amount of Alibaba. Their price per earnings ratio doesn't look bad. It's 44, I believe that was the number I saw quoted, a 44 PE. Now, again, I talked about something like a Home Depot trading for a 20 PE. I think that might be overpriced for a Home Depot because there's already a Home Depot and a Lowe's on every corner, and I just don't see them growing like potentially an Alibaba may be able to grow. Obviously, an internet company or a software company or a services company can grow a lot faster than a brick-and-mortar company can. So Alibaba, particularly being Asian-centric or China-centric, where they have 1.5 billion people they can easily market to, and then they have the whole rest of the world as well, they potentially could grow very fast. So the 44 price-per-earnings ratio may not be out of line, particularly if they're growing it at 50% a year. You can easily see where you would be willing to pay 44 times earnings. My question is, and again, it gets back to that transparency and how much you can trust the bookkeeping of some of these Chinese companies. What's that earnings really based on? Do you remember back to Enron? There really weren't any earnings. Do you remember back to a lot of the dot-com bubble hype companies? There weren't any earnings. Now, again, Alibaba, it's being reported that they have earnings and that the price is based on a 44 PE. That all may be well and true. I'm just a little concerned about the transparency. I'm very cynical of Chinese stocks. I'll just leave it at that. Again, you can draw your own conclusions. Well, I think that'll wrap it up for today. Again, I want to welcome all of our new listeners, and please, as I mentioned in the beginning, reach out to me. Let me know how you found out about the show, which app or which method you're using to listen to it. I suspect many of you aren't coming from iTunes, so I would like to know how you are listening. For those of you that might be aware of places other than the iTunes store where we're getting ratings or reviews, I'd be curious to know that too, because I think they're happening. I just don't know about them. And if you feel the urge to go out and give us a rating or review in the iTunes store, I would really appreciate that. And then finally, again, I'd reiterate about the first 10 episodes. Those are the ones that lay down the foundation of the wealth building principles. They're evergreen material. They're meant and designed for you to go back and listen to again and again. If you haven't done so, or if you haven't listened to them in a while, go back and re-listen to those. Make sure you have a solid foundation and understanding. That'll help you to see through the hype and hopefully will prevent you from getting ripped off. There are a lot of schemes out there. You've worked too hard for your money. Be very cautious. As always, you can contact me at wealthsteading.com. I welcome your comments and your questions. Please plan to join us on the next episode where we'll talk about where to live if you want to be a blue-collar millionaire. Now, even if you're not a blue-collar worker or if you don't plan on moving, you're going to want to listen to this episode because the essence of it will be based on wealth-building principles that you can apply in all areas of your life. So until next time, this is John Pugliano wishing you the best of returns.